Chapter 33, Difficult Questions and Difficult Answers. For a lone prisoner inside a mud jail out in the middle of nowhere, my schedule was getting oddly packed. There were the classes with the captain and the rugs to weave, and the increasingly less secret sessions with Busuku at night through the wall. I was never totally sure he was doing things right, but he certainly grunted in the right places. And, of course, the lessons with the sergeant's boy, Ajit. He had very powerful seeds within him from the start, and it was more simply a task of awakening them. His leg was already improving, and I was always watching for ways of getting at his seeds from the inside. What he needed most was to be around more people, so he'd have more people to help and serve. One day, just after dusk, the corporal came out of the side room for perhaps the 10th time, looking oddly at the door to the road and then back at my cell. I thought he might be expecting someone, but so far I had only seen one person ever come to visit him, the woman who brought a large jug of water to the jail twice a day. The water was drawn from a public well down the road towards town. Every jug meant standing in line for at least an hour. Not that anyone minded. This was where people had a chance to see each other and talk, find out the town gossip. And then the lady would come with the jug and put it on the porch, and sometimes the sergeant or even the captain would come out for the latest news and exchange the usual banter that working men and a lady who comes like that so often do. And so finally the corporal walks stiffly to the door of my cell. But first he turns to Busuku and he says, "Mr. Busuku, I need to ask you a favor, if you will." "What's that, young fellow?" he answered lazily. "Well, you see, I'm going to take Miss Friday somewhere. I hear Busuku getting up off the floor in a comparative flash, ready to defend my honor. "Young man," he says. Oh, it's nothing, sir. You see, what I want to do is take her to my home to see my mother, to see if she can help my mother the way she's helping everyone else." "Ah," says Busuku knowingly. "Well, that, I think, would be wonderful. And one thing, sir, you see, it would be, you know, a real help to me if the sergeant and the captain..." "My lips are sealed," says Busuku with a little chuckle. "And don't dawdle, my boy." "Oh, yes, the sergeant," squeaks the corporal. "Sergeant my arse," growls Busuku. "I just don't want to miss my secret class tonight with Miss Friday. So make sure she gets home on time." "Yes, sir," replies the corporal, his voice quivering. And then the crossbar is up off the door and he is leading me down the road in the growing dark. We walked a long distance, out in the opposite direction from town. The corporal kept his head down, stepped off the road whenever anyone came the other way, and then at some point he turned onto a side road that meandered off to the left through a silent forest of tall single trees growing far apart from each other. It was all very quiet. And then he came to a clearing with a simple but pretty and well-kept cottage of thatched reeds. Inside, there was a wide, clean room with a well-worn, spotless floor of packed clay. In the middle of the room was a mat of woven rushes, upon it a small, low, round table with a lamp made of a wick and melted butter in a lovely little clay dish. And in the halo of the golden light, there was a woman, an old woman, sitting soft and quiet, wrapped in an elegantly simple white cotton sari dress. She greeted me with bright, loving eyes beneath calm, almost sleepy eyelids. "My mother," said Corporal in an introduction. "Miss Friday," he said to Mother. And then he stooped shyly at a water jug and poured us each a cup of clean, cool water. "You may call me Mataji," she said. I smiled. It meant Mother in any language. Then she reached to hand me one of the cups, but she could only push it to me slowly across the top of the table, and I saw that her hands were bent and twisted. The backs curved backward, the wrong way, and the fingers looked straight away from them, locked straight away from them. The corporal cleared his throat and said nervously, you see, Mataji has this problem with her hands. And then he looked to her for help, as I suppose he often did. My son Chandra has told me a lot about you, continued the woman gracefully. And then abruptly, she simply grasped my hands, clumsily but warmly, between her own and closed her eyes. And we were silent like that for I don't know how long. Everything just felt wonderful and silent and peaceful. And then she opened her eyes again, and a small tear made its way down her cheek, and she turned to her son and said, "It will work, Chandra. She is as you said she was, very much like a woman who came into our lives long ago, in the year you were born. Yes, very much like that." She smiled, gazing into my face. "Will you please be so kind as to teach me yoga, repair what age has done?" she asked in a warm wave of humility. "Of course, but of course," was all I could say, and held the incredible warmth of her hands in mind. And then I gazed at the corporal's face, so full of hope and joy, but so tormented by his own dullness, and I added, "But there is one condition, you see. Your son must agree to begin lessons in yoga, lessons from the captain." The woman arched an eyebrow in surprise and looked at the corporal. "Chandra?" she said simply. "Yes, mother," he replied, and it was done. "All right," said the captain. "I have questions, difficult questions, about the first form of self-control, about not harming anyone." "Roll ahead," I smiled. "It is only harming others that creates bad seeds? What if you harm yourself?" he began. "Something like trying to commit suicide." "Yes, exactly," I said. "The main point of not harming anyone is to avoid doing any damage to that incredibly rare and precious vehicle that we ride around in, our body. In its current condition, it is either a wreck already or a wreck waiting to happen. But simply put, we really need it right now. So we can do what we need to do to plant the right seeds to see it change into something that's not a wreck, something that is of service." "Exactly," I said. "And so knowingly doing harm to your own body, or your own mind for that matter, plants very powerful negative seeds. We must be as kind to ourselves as we are to others." Here the captain paused and then said, "It's not here on the list of questions," and I saw he had actually written himself out reminders of what to ask, "but it's something practical I'd like to know." "Nothing's more practical than ideas," I said, "but go ahead." "It's about the sergeant," he went on. "I need to know, are there any poses, any special ways of breathing or doing the silent sitting that would especially be effective to help someone like him? Help him stop hurting himself with the alcohol?" I nodded. "It's a common problem, not just with alcohol, but with any other kind of compulsive behavior. You see, people's lives taken over and controlled by just about anything. Drinking, drugs, eating, smoking, sex, talking too much, doing too much. And the answer is that the best thing you can do is just take him through the very same thing we've been doing together. A short but very regular daily practice of the poses. Basic, but very regular daily breathing exercises. And brief, but very regular daily sitting silently, taking away the same problems from others and sending them happiness, all upon the breath. You see, with yoga, as we've talked about it, this regular, modest, daily practice causes very profound changes in the level of the channels in the inner winds. And that has a matching effect on the thoughts and attitudes themselves. Any person who just keeps this up steadily, a little each day, just naturally begins to avoid these bad habits because these simply don't fit anymore into who they are. And then one day they just naturally drop the habit completely. No big announcement, no big resolution. They may not even notice. The captain nodded his thanks and went on with his questions. But about this suicide thing, what if the person is in a lot of pain? What if life has become unbearable? And who cares about the seeds if you die? I looked at him gravely and felt Katrin's cold still flowing into me. I searched desperately for a metaphor that he could relate to. You have a house. It has two rooms and one door to the outside. You're in the living room that has the door to the outside. And there's a friend with you. And in the room, there are 20 small children running around playing a game and screaming. Your friend has a bad headache. He says he can't bear it anymore. You say you'll let him out the front door, but it happens to be locked. You asked him to hold on a while you find the key. He says no, he truly can't bear it anymore, and he will go instead into the second room. But you know that inside that second room there's a savage dog, immense in size, and it's desperately hungry. And you know that it will rip your friend to pieces the moment he enters the room. I stopped, fixed my eyes coldly on the captain. He shifted uncomfortably in his seat and finally looked up. It's hardly a good example, he said, a little defensively. I mean, I suppose you're saying that we must go on somewhere after we die, but personally, I cannot believe that, and no matter what they say, I don't think many other people do either. We see people, we see them die. The body stops and it's still, and the life seeps out, and then they lie there cold and dead, and it's over. We can see it's over. A sort of anger came into me, hot now, like Katrin too. I will put it to you bluntly, Captain. The one and only reason that people think we don't go on after the body stops is just that they can see that the body has stopped. But if you are completely honest with yourself for even a single moment, you must say that you cannot be sure the person's mind has stopped just because their body has stopped. Because when the body stops, then the mind can no longer send messages to the outside. No hands to wave, no tongue to speak, no eyes to blink. And so the whole world believes, whether they admit it or not, that the person and the person's mind have stopped too, with no better proof than the body that no longer moves. It's like saying a person riding in a coach must be dead if the coach breaks a wheel and stops. It's exactly the same thing, let's be honest. At least admit that you're not sure if the mind goes on. No one is sure if the mind goes on someplace. The captain shook his head once, curtly, and looked down. I could feel he was starting to get a little upset. But the wild dog thing, I mean, come on, and brimstone and all that. Fire came into me then, and I struggled to hold it back because I really didn't want him to get upset. I simply wanted him to be aware of the dangerous power of seeds. Captain, please, look at your life. Look even at just your life today. You got up out of bed. You woke up. Thousands upon thousands of images flashed before you and your world as you dressed, as you ate breakfast, as you walked to the station, and just another normal day of work. And it was life as usual, nothing tremendously happy or sad. But you see, just to maintain the flow of reasonably pleasant images, the toast for breakfast, the feel of the morning air, the touch of your own body, the song of your thoughts, just to maintain what you take as normal life, it requires many thousands of seeds ripening instant after instant, presenting each detail of each object around you in your mind, instant by instant, layer by layer. All these are good seeds, you see. The very cream of all the countless seeds that you've planted in your mind. And we use them up like that, you see, unknowingly, unaware, not even guessing at how many kind and wonderful actions we did towards others to create these seeds. And so the store of good seeds dwindles, which is why we grow old. And then, when they are gone completely, we call it death, which we see as ourselves dying. When the new seeds wake up, and these new seeds, how to say it to him, how to say this, I couldn't think of anything but to be blunt with it. Captain, we are awake for say 16 to 18 hours a day, for about 1,000 minutes. Throughout the day, we purposely do or speak or think something kind to others, I mean really kind to others, purposely only what, 5, 10, 15 times? maybe half an hour total. And then most of the rest, especially in our private thoughts, is spent viewing others in a critical way, in a judgmental way, in a competitive way, wrapped in a daze of selfishness. And so, if we do go on somewhere after death, and you really cannot prove that we do not, then we go on with a storehouse of seeds which are almost all negative. I'm not saying that some big evil spirit has run around the world building invisible little rooms with big bad dogs in them. There's no such thing. I'm saying that if the thing with the pen is right, and you know it is, then the seeds that every one of us carry to our death are certainly enough to see to make us be in places infinitely more painful than the most hopeless shred of life in this world. And so we must not kill, we must never even dream of killing others or ourselves. The captain was silent for a long, tense moment, and then sighed heavily. I felt tense myself. I am the teacher. I must say these things, even if he doesn't want to hear them, even if he thinks they're stupid or wrong. A student is like a mother's child. The teacher is like a mother. Could a mother ever let her child open the door of that second room without at least trying to give warning? He glanced down at his list, tense. Well, what about animals? What about hurting and killing animals? When the master says not to harm anyone, he is referring to animals as well. You see, in the ancient language, the word anyone and person refer to animals too, anything that is conscious. But animals don't have feelings, he replied curtly, something I guess he had heard as an adult say when he was young. Then why do you scratch my dog's ears? I was beginning to feel strained.
Obviously, some animals, like pets and so on, they obviously have feelings. That's what makes it so fun to take care of them. They respond with so much affection. But animals like fish? And have you never stood at the banks of the river and seen a fisherman set that cruel steel hook in the mouth of a fish and struggle to bring him in, and the fish fights with his last strength to escape, even flying out of his own world into the air in which he cannot live, from the pain of it? How can you say he's not feeling anything? The captain's face reddened. Well, I mean that, yes, but, you know, all those smaller animals, so insignificant, almost stupid. Fire got hotter in me. Babies, human babies, are small and stupid, too, you see. It makes them defenseless, really. It is the small ones, the defenseless ones, that deserve never to be the objects of our harm. Your own heart tells you that. I don't need to say it. It is humankind's one most glorious trait, and we feel the urge to protect those who are weak and defenseless. The captain let out another sharper sigh. I didn't know what to do. Perhaps I don't have enough experience to be teaching all these things to someone. Perhaps I should ask him to find a better teacher, an older one, someone who can explain all of this without making him angry. And what about plants? He said tersely. The ancient books are clear in saying that the plants are not sentient life, not like humans. Plants respond to nutrients and grow, but the ancient books say more like the way that crystals do, and not with conscious feelings, so we cannot harm them in that sense. These same books, though, are quite clear to say that we should respect plants and do our best not to damage or destroy them without compelling need. And this is because they provide homes for countless smaller creatures. The captain rolled his eyes. Captain, sir, I am just trying, but then I thought it better just to go on. Perhaps we could reach a quiet point later where I could tell him I didn't mean to upset him. He looked at his list again. You mentioned babies, he said, sounding a little aggressive now. What about a baby in the womb? This one was easy. So clear in all the ancient books. Do you remember, I began, when we spoke about how a baby forms in the womb? He nodded stiffly. I do. The flesh and bones form around the patterns of the subtle channels, like layers of ice around the contours of a twig. And so even the major joints that begin to pain us later in our lives have formed around knots in the channels that were there as early as the womb. But how early? I nodded and took it straight from the ancient sources. When the sperm of the father meets the egg of the mother, in this first instant, then something we call a bindu enters at the same moment, a spark of consciousness, a pinpoint of awareness, one of those stars that the master spoke of. And then this pinpoint of awareness begins to move and the first channel begins to sprout. And as they do, the first cell splits for the first time. And so there's consciousness, a very basic form of awareness and life, even in the first moment. And it is, again, defenseless life, and it deserves our kindness and care all the more. The captain reached out and took his pen in his fingers and squeezed it tightly. His knuckles went white against the flesh, not a good sign. My mind raced to think of ways to make him happy and me again. In that moment, it felt more important than teaching him, really. He glanced one last time at his little list and then tossed it down on the table with something bordering on disgust. "War," he said. "The king starts a war, say. Now I understand the part about what I should do myself already. I mean, if someone is hurting someone else, we must try to restrain them without violence and without hatred, without starting the circle spinning back on us one more time. That much we've already talked about, but let's say that even if I don't go out to fight the enemy myself, I support the war effort by paying taxes. Now my question is this, if a soldier on the front line then kills someone, do I have some part of it? Do I plant seeds in my mind just because I helped pay for it?" I nodded, eager to satisfy at least one of his questions. The ancient books were quite clear on this as well. A lot of how seeds are planted depends on your motivation, your intention. If you really didn't want to support the war effort, but you were compelled by law to pay taxes that ultimately contribute to the effort, then yes, some small negative seeds could be planted, even in your own mind. If, however, you went further and made an effort to inform the authorities that you did not support your taxes being used to do violence towards others, if you worked earnestly and honestly and without violence to discourage violence, then you would plant very good seeds in your mind. But if you, in your mind, without thinking of the tremendous pain done to anyone on either side who lost a son or daughter or even just a home or their crops, if you, as you went through your daily life, thought about the war sometimes vaguely and felt that it was all right, well then, the ancient books are very clear. If a single person dies in a single remote battle, it is exactly as if you stood before them with a knife and plunged it into their heart. That kind of seed is planted in your mind. And that kind of pain comes back to you, infinitely greater, when the evil tree has grown from the evil seed. The captain held the pen up and then actually threw it across the room. My heart was pounding. I didn't know what to do. I began to wish that maybe we had just done some poses and had a good sweat together. This wasn't the way I wanted it to be between us. I really had felt so close to him. "Too much," he cried, "too much. I mean these ideas of yours, not mine," I began to protest. "No matter," he cried. "These ideas, I can't accept them. I mean they go against what, well, just about everybody knows and what everybody says, and some of them, they're just old-fashioned. I mean, modern thinking has gone way beyond them. They are quaint, I guess. They are just, you could say they are good-hearted, well-intended, but they just aren't up to the level of thinking which is current, which is sophisticated, which is the result of the constant refinement and sensibilities of whole societies here in the realm for the past 600 years, he proclaimed. My head was starting to spin, but then a voice came to me from inside, the voice of the master. It calmed me, and I repeated out loud what it told me. "On this, Captain, the master says, the various forms of self-control are mighty codes of conduct meant for people in every stage of their personal development. They go beyond differences in race or social status. They go beyond the borders between countries. They go beyond what is modern or old. They go beyond the various creeds and convictions." The master is saying, you see, that what we do to help or to hurt others is at the bottom of everything. Nothing works, not yoga or any other thing we ever do, unless we have been careful to plant the seeds in our mind to see it work. And he says this one thing especially with such passion. It is obviously the core of yoga. for the great father of all yoga, the core of all he ever says. The captain's face went tight. His mouth was a thin, taut line of tension, and then he blurted out, "I don't know if I really care what the master says." My face snapped back as if it had been slapped. My mind went cold and my heart hurt. But then the corporal came in and saved us. Chapter 34, World View. If we've been trying very hard to plant good seeds in our minds, slowly and steadily for a while, then sometimes we get a glimpse of what life will be like in the end, and a little miracle comes to help. And so just at one of the most difficult moments in my life in the jail, there was a little commotion outside the window. I felt the magic. I clasped the captain's hand in my own and pulled him to see what it was, before he had the chance to think about it. We saw the corporal, sitting there in the dust like a little boy, the bottom of his white cotton pants getting all brown. Around him stood a little cluster of insistent sparrows, rushing in little groups to small pieces of his mother's flatbed bread that he had tossed around them in a circle. His face was alive with childlike joy at their happiness. And we stood and watched, the captain and I, at the window, our hands touching, and the tension flowing away. The sunlight poured in happily and caught our faces, and I saw his handsome features relax at the corporal's lovely innocence. The little birds pulled at pieces of the bread, chirping furiously as if they were playing tug-of-war. And then beautiful little red birds, like finches, landed and ended the sparrows' tussles, chasing them away on both sides and grabbing the pieces themselves. They were followed by squawking jays that did the same to the finches, and finally two huge black crows swooped down and sent everyone else on their way, devouring all the bread the corporal had. And he laughed and got up happily and dusted off everything, except the big round circle on his backside, and walked slowly out of sight to the porch. The captain turned to me, the touch had healed us and gone, and said gently, "I'm sorry I got upset. You know, I really do have great respect for the master and for everything you've spoken of. It's just that sometimes it's hard when he says something that sort of goes against a lot of what we grew up with. It takes time, I think, to figure all this out." I nodded. It was the same for me when my teacher first introduced a lot of these ideas to me. I dare say I was more stubborn than you are, much more set in my view of the world, even though I was so young. And then the crows took off into the air with their sharp, loud caws, and I looked at the little tiny crumbs of bread and the dirt, and the sparrows who had been there first began to hop back to see what they could salvage. "Sometimes I wonder," I said quietly, leaning on my elbows on the windowsill. "Wonder what?" he said, leaning out next to me, and we drank in the fresh air. "I mean, look at life. Look at just the way life works with the birds. Each one is absolutely intent on getting a piece of the bread for himself. And there is a natural order of things, you see, if you have the bread. But if I show up and I'm bigger and stronger than you, I simply take it away. And the same if someone bigger and stronger than me shows up, and that's just the way it goes, or so it seems. And that's how people have lived too, most people, for as long as there have been people. But then you have to imagine that there was a time, maybe long ago, somewhere, say, in a cave or something, when humans first began, and one human comes in with maybe some berries or a little animal to roast, and he sits down to eat it. But then he sees that there's already another human there in the cave, and there's a tense moment while the two look at each other and see who's bigger and stronger. I mean, who will take the food from the other? And then something odd comes into the first one's mind, and he takes his berries or whatever and just hands them, some of them, maybe all of them, over to the other person without a struggle, without a fight, just because he feels how hungry the other one is. And then maybe the next day, the first human goes out again looking for some food, and he is special, you see, and he notices the food seems a lot easier to find on that day. And then some unspeakably holy, sacred string of thought passes through his mind, and he says to himself, "Maybe the food is easier to find for me today because I shared my food yesterday." I felt excited just thinking about that first glint of understanding, and I felt it begin, too, in the captain's mind. "You see," I went on, looking into his face, "you see, he doesn't have any idea about seeds or pens or mental images forming because of kindness, the kindness he saw himself do. He just has a flash of insight, a feeling. He's framing in that moment the greatest invention that humankind has ever created. Kindness. Maybe not human-created, divine-sourced. And you see, it's not just an instinct with him anymore at that moment. I mean, he's not like an animal feeding his own young or anything. He's moving up to a whole new level of humanity, an evolution, an awakening of the human spirit. Because he's beginning to undertake kindness as a principle, as part of the way he sees the world work. He's showing kindness to another being because his very view of reality is changing. He's developing this new worldview where he grasps that the very things and events around him may be created by the kindness he shows to others. And at some point, this worldview graduates to an even higher evolution. He sees not only that he can fulfill his own needs with this way of viewing the world, he sees that everyone else could fulfill their needs in this way too. If he simply passes on to them what he's learned, sharing his discovery of how kindness changes things, as he first shared his food. And so I guess you could call that moment the birth of yoga, or whatever name you call this divine understanding of who we are, our natural kindness and the sharing of kindness. And you see, I breathed to him, this is all I meant to say today. This kind of thing, the human discovery of kindness, it goes beyond all differences in people or countries or times. And like all discoveries, like all great ideas, it can get lost for a while in any one particular culture. Cultures, civilizations, they're just like individual people. They may be doing very well on the whole, good on a large scale, but then just like any one of us, they might make a mistake as a whole people. I sat him back down at the desk, but I took his hand again in mine to make what I had to say easier. I mean, I will give you an example. It's just an example. And it may be hard for you, and I don't mean it to be. I just want it to be something you won't forget. The captain agreed with his eyes, warm, moist. It must be the same for anyone in the world who imagines the very discovery of kindness, especially kindness wrapped in real understanding. There is a young man, say, I began. He grows up in the countryside and then comes to the city to find his career. And he manages to get a job at an office somewhere. And there are young men working there, young men from the city. And then one evening they take him out for dinner, say, and they serve him some liquor. And he's watching all of them, and there's kind of a ritual around the liquor. The waiter comes with a flourish, the bottle is opened grandly, and immediately there is a kind of excitement and anticipation among his fellows. And rounds are poured for everyone and downed, and he drinks this too, even though it just tastes to him like some terrible soup of rotten wheat or something. But it seems to be the thing to do, and he goes along with it to fit in. And after some time, he gets used to the taste. And he finds out at some point that it really is just the wastewater from rotten grains or fruits, but that people in the city consider it quite important and very sophisticated, even arguing between them whether the wastewater from one rotten grain is more smooth or mellow, or whatever barley rotted for a few months in copper kettles tastes better than the grapes rotted for a few years in wooden barrels, things like that. And to him, they all taste pretty much the same. Just the taste of something that is spoiled. But he doesn't let on because, you see, this liquor thing seems to be like something that the people who live in the city should know about and use constantly. It has an aura of romance or adventure or kinship, something. And so he learns to drink. And the people around him teach him to drink, simply by their example. And then one day, someone close to the young man dies, you see, and he has this tremendous pain that never lets up, even for a moment, even at night for sleep. And he finds out that if he drinks a lot of the rotten water, then the pain is numbed for a few hours. And then the drinking grows and grows, and it gradually takes over his life. And then it gets ugly, and the very people who taught him to drink don't want anything to do with him anymore. And then gradually, you see, his own life is ruined. And for the sake of any companionship at all, he draws others into his drinking. And then perhaps even one day he drinks too much and then causes an accident. And someone very innocent is hurt seriously. And then on that day he wakes up and realizes something, that this liquor thing, this adventure and ritual of the fine drink, it was all simply one horrible, useless tragedy. A simple and terrible mistake in the path his life has taken. The captain's head was bowed with the pain of remembering it all. I squeezed his hand tight and brought his eyes back up to mine. And so you see, there are things, there are ways of behaving, there are ways of viewing the things around us that a person, as he or she goes through their life, simply discovers are a mistake. And they discover it the hard way. And people, real people, good, honest people, they get hurt. They get hurt sometimes in a way that can't be fixed. And on a larger scale, whole countries, whole cultures, whole civilizations even, they can make mistakes the very same way an individual person can. I mean, the liquor is a good example. What is it, really? Just an accident. Good, honest food like barley or wheat that could have been made into bread to fill the bellies of the poor and the children of the poor who are always with us, and this food is left somewhere to become wet, to rot or spoil, and then a whole network of mystique takes over and packages it and sells it and serves it, makes it seem exciting and sophisticated. And then it goes into people's bodies, and a great many of them can't control themselves, and gradually it causes them great illness and sadness, a sadness that spreads and poisons the lives of their wives and husbands and children. In the culture, you see, the viewpoint they grew up with about liquor, that it's something exciting, something that will bring companionship or romance into their lives, this viewpoint will survive the ones who are destroyed by it. And so the culture, which is really just a big group of people over a lot of generations, has been infected by a viewpoint, by a way of viewing the world, which not only doesn't help the people who are the culture, but actually does them great harm. These same viewpoints, though, you see, can be strong once they get started. They have momentum. And that's because of the way they are passed down from one generation to another. I mean, most of our viewpoints about, say, harming other beings are not something that we in any way came up with on our own. They were passed down to us. Almost everything we do and almost everything we believe in, we do or believe in for one reason and for one reason only. It was what our parents taught us. It was what we learned from older brother or sister. It's what we saw around us. It's what the teachers in the school said when we were very small. And it is what everyone else does. It is what everyone else believes. And they are only doing or believing in it because someone else did it before them, and for no better reason. And so you see, a very bad way of acting, a very bad way of thinking about things, downpolling, harmful, it can just keep itself going blindly, madly, from generation to generation, like the myth of fine liquor. The master is talking about this when he says, the sixth obstacle is a mistaken view of the world left uncorrected. I mean, liquor is just a small example. There are other worldviews which can simply destroy an entire civilization unnoticed. The idea that war could end violence, the idea that the number of things you have in your house or the size of your house could even remotely make you happier. The idea that you obtain things by competing aggressively against others who also want those things and not by doing the opposite. The idea that you must die, that death is an ending, the idea that you must grow old and growing older is painful, the idea that a body made of pure light in a perfect world of light is only a fairy tale, only some old myth, and not something real that you can reach simply by undertaking a very simple and sincere series of practical steps as we are doing now. And so the great masters of old, you see, wherever they have lived around the world, they have taught their people to follow the code of self-control. And before it was a rule, it was a code, a personal code, a way of life that you kept from the inside, not because somebody outside told you it was a law and you had to do it. You followed it because you knew it would put seeds in you that would create a perfect body and mind to carry into a perfect world. And you knew that if you could do it yourself, then you could really help others do it too. And so here is where the Master grants us the great gift of the highest form of self-control of all. It is not the act of avoiding harm to our body or the bodies of others. It is not anything that we say kind or cruel. It is how we see things. For this view of the world through the lens of kindness, this worldview, is what will determine what all of us do in our words and actions, and what we pass on to our children for them to follow. And he says finally that we must be willing, for the sake of others and the children who come after us, to examine how we view the world, to think about what we have learned from all those around us and all who came before us, and see if it is really helpful and uplifting. See if it really works the way everyone said it did, or perhaps see that it does not work at all and never did, like the lie of liquor. And if we discover that a worldview does not work, if it does not help people, if it does not really bring happiness, then we must have the courage to stop following it, to help correct it, and not blindly pass it on to our children, something that will not work for them either, something that may even hurt them. And so what I mean, Captain, is that I'm offering you new ideas, a new way of viewing the world, a new way of understanding how things really work, and how we can stop even the grand mistakes of unhappiness, the aging, painful aging of the body and death itself. You must listen with an open mind, a mind opened by the realization that the way we were taught to view the world simply does not work on these most important points of our life. And if the new viewpoint doesn't seem to make sense, then you must ask questions about it until you are satisfied, or else you should wait on it, or even reject it too, and continue with your search elsewhere. But if you examine these ideas, this new, most ancient worldview, and you find that they do make sense, then you must have the courage to give them a good try, for your own sake and for the sake of others. And that is something. I drew myself up tall, as Katrin would have. And that is something much different from throwing your pen across the room every time you are presented with an idea that is new to you, but which may very well actually save your life and the lives of all you care about. I stopped finally, but kept hold of his hand. He was just staring into my face, mesmerized again by the real possibilities that were opening up. The dream of a perfect world is too strong to die in our minds, even after we cross the border into adulthood. It just needs waking up sometimes. He nodded silently, solemnly, and we went and did our giving and taking, and our breathing, and knocking on the pipes with our good old sweaty poses. "We've got to get all this organized before it gets completely out of control," announced the sergeant. He was talking to Busuku and me, face to face, huddled in a little trio on the floor of my cell. Busuku and I were too surprised to do anything more than just listen to him as he went on intensely. "I mean, there's just too many people involved now to let it go haphazardly," he continued, oblivious to our uncomprehending stares. "Now, as I see it, first priority is Miss Friday's weekly class with the captain, since the captain has to turn around and pass those on to the corporal and myself right afterwards. So, that should take place, say, on Monday mornings, early as possible." He looked up at the window. "I'll inform the captain," he said, and he made a note on a little piece of paper before him. "Now, my boy Ajit, he should be coming in, say, right after that,
on Monday, since children are so much more fresh before noon. That means you'll have to get your boys in by mid-morning too, Busuku. Busuku's incomprehension deepened noticeably. That is, if that fits with Miss Friday's weaving schedule. And the sergeant looked at me, but I was catching as little of this as Busuku, who finally stirred himself. Ravi, what on earth do you mean about my boys? What do they have to do with all of this? He demanded. Ah, that, rushed on the sergeant, hardly even pausing. I was at home last night thinking about the captain's last class with Miss Friday. Here he reddened a bit, but Busuku saved him. Oh, I get it, exclaimed Busuku, his face alive with his thoughts. Oh, brilliant, Ravi. You're going to put that worldview thing into practice right away. Break out of that idiot worldview of taking care of just ourselves, the worldview that everyone drilled into us growing up. Taking care of the other boys, too, so you can see the yoga work on them and your boy. The key to how yoga really works, and the ultimate worldview, taking care of others. Attaboy, Ravi! And he gave the sergeant a hearty slap on the back that sent him choking. Then to me, Busuku winked and said, Oh, that was a great last class with the captain, Miss Friday. We were all eavesdropping and cheering you on. Ravi said he was going to go in and plow those new worldview seeds into the captain's head with his stick if he ever threw his pen across the room again. Didn't you, Ravi? And Busuku slapped the sergeant again on the back, which sent him choking again, and whispered to me, Seeds. It's seeds ripening. From smacking you and me before, you see, and I'm just helping them ripen. And he slammed the sergeant's back one last time for good measure. When he had mostly recovered, the sergeant went on, shifting a bit out of Busuku's range without even thinking. And then, Miss Friday, what I see is a quick lunch for you. We'll see that you get a nice proper dinner later in the evening. And then the class with the corporal's mother, I guess 3 days a week would be enough to start? I nodded dumbly, overwhelmed by all of it. Good. Then it's all decided. He stood quickly and tapped Busuku lightly on the head with the end of his stick. Now, back to your cell, rotund one. I need a few words with Miss Friday privately. Busuku worked himself up with a groan. I can't believe you made me do the long bow pose 3 times last night, he moaned to me and shuffled off to his cell. And don't forget again to come and bar my door, he yelled back to the sergeant. People walk in and look at me funny like I'm too dumb to escape, you know, he whined. The sergeant squatted down next to me. I really want to thank you for Ajit, he began, and almost started to cry, which started me crying. He's so much happier. He hasn't been able to walk this well in years, not since. I nodded quickly. It needn't be said. And he asked me to ask you if you would let him take Long Life out for walks. You see, say once in the morning and once in the evening. He says he thinks he's figured out a way. And the sergeant stopped, laughing and almost crying. A way to make Long Life's legs all better. Some kind of yoga poses for puppies that Ajit says he's worked out during his silent sitting. I nodded. That would be wonderful. That would be wonderful for Long Life and wonderful seeds for Ajit. Then that's decided too, said the sergeant, checking his paper once more and then folding and slipping it into his shirt pocket. On the way out the door, he turned and said, Ajit has also offered to give Long Life a bath, say once a week. That way he won't be bringing in any fleas. Fleas, I said. I mean, yes, fleas. I don't want a dog staying in one of our cells and bringing in fleas. My mouth dropped open. In or out, smiled the sergeant, and he strolled out to the front porch into the sunlight. Chapter 35, Matching Pictures. On to the second form of self-control, I announced to the captain and to the back of the door. And to the mud wall on the other side, where I knew they were listening. Actually, I thought it was a pretty efficient way of teaching 3 classes at once. The captain looked at me eagerly. I could tell he'd been thinking things over hard. The rightness of it all had touched him in deep places and given him hope to replace doubt. Then suddenly his forehead wrinkled a bit, and I knew there was a question, and I nodded for it to come. It's about the caveman, he began slowly. I nodded again. I mean,
he went on. You talk about him discovering kindness, and I understand that, and it's truly an inspiration. But then I was thinking about it, and it began to seem to me that he was being kind to others not because it would help them, but because it would help himself. And to tell you the truth, that doesn't set right in my heart. I nodded a third time. It was a common concern and a valid one. There's something here you have to realize, I began, and then it will come clear. You see, it's not a question of my happiness or another's happiness, although our minds are often setting it up that way. Separation. If you are really committed to helping others reach some kind of ultimate happiness, if that is what you live for, then in the end of all ends, you will come to realize that you can only do so by reaching this happiness within yourself, so that you can come back and show them how to do it. And here is where the seeming paradox comes in. You can only reach your own happiness if you are already doing it for others. So this is how it works. You want to help others be happy, so you work towards that happiness yourself. Wanting to help others lets you reach it. And then you are in a position to carry out what you wanted in the first place, to bring others there to happiness. He gazed up and thought for a while, and then looked back down with a smile. What you're saying, he concluded, is that no one can be happy unless everyone is happy, and that everyone won't be happy until one is? He paused and then added, or you can say that we can't leave ourselves out when we undertake to make the whole world happy. Another pause. Because we are part of the whole world. And he grinned brightly. You've got it, I smiled back, and we started on again. Now the master says that the second form of self-control is always telling the truth. Well, that's pretty clear, said the captain in that voice that said, well, actually, you know, I almost never lie. I gazed at him thoughtfully. You know, most of us, I said slowly, we sort of think we already don't do so badly with all these different kinds of self-control. But there's a difference between, you see, sort of a socially acceptable level of self-control and the amount of self-control we all show to each other anyway, in an amount that prevents the world from being a total madhouse all the time, and the degree of self-control we have to cultivate in ourselves if we ever hope to see major change in the seeds we're creating, in the vibration we're creating. I mean, think of a cow setting out on the task of turning a stick, which is something to eat, into a pen whose existence and function is almost totally beyond her comprehension. And then you get a very good feeling for your own efforts to plant seeds in your mind so powerful that they change the entire physical and mental being to the level of pure and angelic creatures. Possible. Not easy. Our efforts at self-control have to become a constant song within us that we sing as we pass through every moment of the day. And with telling the truth, this means that it's not enough simply not to tell frequent blatant lies. I mean, that much we avoid already, and it has not been enough to alter our very reality. Truth for us has to reach deeper now, a new level. And the ancient books say that this means striving as we speak, never to create even the smallest misimpression in the mind of the person listening to us. The picture they get in their mind after we say what we have to say must match as closely as we can get it to match the picture we ourselves have in our mind already about the thing we're speaking of. The closer these two pictures match is truth. Any difference created on purpose between the two pictures is lying. Enough of a lie so that we would never, say, see a person come into our lives and explain to us how yoga really works. The captain frowned ever so slightly and stared at his desk and then at the piles of reports stacked more neatly now around his seat. Now that's a lot more difficult than simply not lying, he began. No, it is what it really means not to lie, I contended. Ah, yes, he said slowly, I suppose that's right. It doesn't take a lot of thought to see that. And then he considered a moment longer. But it seems like it would be extremely difficult to reach and maintain that level of honesty, he said frankly. At first, I admitted, but people are funny that way. You see, we can get used to anything if we really try. You just start small and steady, and then you build up. I mean, you and I can both imagine a society where this level of truthfulness is simply the norm that everyone lives by, but they have been trained that way from childhood, and the whole culture supports and expects and rewards total honesty. In the end, it's just a habit, like anything else. If we truly consider the rewards, say, escape from the effects of painful old age or death, then there is certainly enough incentive that we could do it if we really tried. I felt then the captain feeling the immensity of the effort, especially since we were both already in a culture that would not support us very much if we really tried this new level of honesty. And so I decided to tell him about the book then and there. There's a way you can do it, I said. It's a way that has been taught for thousands of years. You see, in the old days, even before paper, people who wanted to learn to keep these different forms of self-control on a very fine level, they'd go out and say, go to the bank of the river to collect good-sized handful of smooth pebbles, half the pebbles white, half the pebbles dark, just little pebbles, you see, about the size of peas. They'd keep the pebbles, say, in a little bag, and they'd keep that and another small pouch with them all day. And then, if they caught themselves telling even the smallest lie or something like that, they'd right away reach in and take a dark pebble out of the bigger bag and put it in the little pouch. If, on the other hand, they did something to protect life, say, maybe showed someone how to do a yoga pose or anything else that was good and helpful, well, then they'd stop and put a white pebble in with the black one. And then at the end of the day, they'd empty out the little pouch, count the white and black pebbles, and see if they'd taken a step ahead or a step back in trying to fill their mind with better seeds. And nowadays, the way we do it is simply carry a little notebook around with us in a pocket, and three times a day, say before we eat, we pull it out and jot down the one best white seed we planted in the last few hours and the worst one we planted. The ancient masters of yoga did this six times a day, and then at night, before they went to sleep, they looked over their list to see how they had done. Take joy in the white seeds and think on the black ones. And as they actually fell off to sleep, they'd make plans for doing better the next day, doing better when they got up the following morning. Because you see, it's not enough just to, say, read a book that tells you how the yoga poses work. That will never work for you if you're in the habit of hurting others or telling lies, even something like little white lies to your boss at work. You need a system that you can follow every day, all day, to actually get results. And that's what we call the book. Start today, if you'd like, and review your day, pluses, minuses. At the very least, do it once before you go to sleep. Go through each of the five forms of self-control you will learn and make yourself a note about the best and the worst you did with each one. Stick to small, real, and specific things that happened that day. And as you fall off to sleep, plan your attack for the next day. The captain nodded once with that military nod of his, and I knew he had caught it and would try it. But he also seemed distracted by something else, and his eyes kept wandering back to the stacks of reports. Finally, he said, "Now there's something that you said just now. You mentioned white lies to the boss at work. But I have a problem with that, you see, because, well, suppose you've made a mistake on a small project your boss has given you, and you know that in a day or two you could probably fix it, and no one would ever be the wiser, but then the boss comes and asks whether there are any problems with the project he's given you in a case like that, knowing he'd be angry with you if you said anything. Wouldn't it be easier if you just told a little white lie?" He looked up at me sheepishly and I gave him that little pout of disappointment that I used to get from Katrin. "Now, Captain, I'm surprised at you. Of course you wouldn't want to tell a lie, even a little white lie, and you tell me why.
The captain fidgeted for a moment with his pen, trying to think how to avoid the obvious, and then a muffled cry came through the wall from the back of the jail. "Doesn't work," it said. "Shut up, Busuku," burst out the sergeant, sounding as if his ear were still glued to the door. "Cultural mistake," yelled Busuku again. "Busuku," screamed the sergeant. "Civilization mistake," roared Busuku. And then the sergeant struck his stick hard on the floor 3 times, and silence ensued. The captain got red and then smiled. "Well, he's right, you know," he said quietly. "Busuku's right. If everything we're saying is true, it can't be that telling the truth to my boss would make him get angry at me. I mean, it's like the lie and the extra money. They may come one right after the other, and so the lie seems to cause the extra money. But really, a bad seed can't create a good result any more than the seeds from a thorn bush could grow into grapevines." And so there too, so here too, a good seed telling the truth could never create a bad result. The boss getting angry at you, what Busuku is saying, continued the captain, is that even little white lies don't work. That is, they don't work all the time, which proves that if the boss doesn't get angry at me, it's not because I fed him a white lie. And even the idea of a white lie, even the words white lie, they are just another mistake our whole culture has made and made together. It is, as Busuku said so rightly, even a mistake that our entire civilization has made century after century. And if I guess right, it is the seeds of mistaken ideas like this that throttle even a civilization's life in the end. In the same way that harmful actions we do towards others create the knots in our channels that make us, as individuals, get old painfully and die. I looked at my pupil with pride. Now he was beginning to sound like Katrin. "And you will find," I said then, "that consistently being completely honest over an extended period of time does work, and works all the time. You will find that it creates an ever higher upward spiral, where boss and fellow worker and family begin to honor and respect you for all you say. And whatever old seeds you had to see people upset with you when you told the truth are eventually choked off." "There's a point there," interjected the captain. "Is there any way to just go after those old bad seeds and get rid of them before they ripen into something unpleasant?" "Later," I smiled, but it was the most wonderful question. "Now, a final point about honesty. Before we get down to your poses," the captain grimaced a bit, as does every student whose hopes of getting out of their daily work has been smashed. "Since you are already teaching others, it's important that you know the most powerful kind of honesty there is. And that is always being careful to teach this knowledge of yoga, this wonderful, powerful worldview, exactly as you have learned it. Never throwing in some idea that's occurred to you that you might think is right. Never leaving out any of the important ideas that are already part of the tradition. Because you see, the teachings on this way, the information in the master's short book, they are like a list of instructions drawn up by a master physician to treat a person who's just been bitten by a deadly snake. The instructions have been written down by the best there is, and they work. Now, suppose someone like you or me, someone even with a fair amount of training and certainly with the best intentions, comes along and begins throwing in unnecessary instructions or even taking out necessary ones. Then what happens is, well, you know, that party game for children when the 10 kids sit in the row and the first one whispers something to the second and so on all the way to the 10th, and then the last child says what he thinks he heard. And it's always very funny because it's not at all what the first child whispered. But here, with these instructions, it's not so much a joke. They work as they were intended and they were written down. And if we do not maintain a high level of honesty around them, that is, if we change them or especially make claims about our own experiences with them, they are not completely true, then we are already whispering something different into the next child's ear. And if the person we have whispered to is foolish enough to do the same and so on down the line, then at some point the instructions are changed so much that they no longer work. And then someone who's been bitten by a snake,
any one of the countless people alive now or in the future who are struggling to beat off the Lord of Death, they will try to practice the instructions as they have received them, and these instructions will not help. And so this seed, perhaps the most terrible seed of all, we must at all costs avoid.